As you all know, the court returned to its home in August, and we have a beautifully refurbished courtroom and chambers, and everything is working very well except the sound system. The sound system worked very well yesterday, but overnight it rebelled. And the computer apparently lost all its memory, the computer that runs the sound system. So you may not hear us, we may not hear you, and there may be this humming sound and feedback, but we're going to proceed as best we can, okay? So with that stated, and again, well, I always ask the audience to raise their hands. Each of you raise your hand if you can't hear. Not because it's going to help you hear, but because it might help us cure the problems. But under any event, we will proceed. I'll call the first case for today, 00-0420, Manitowoc Western Company versus Alan Montonen. And we will first hear from Mr. Phillips, Attorney Phillips, representing Alan Montonen. Mr. Phillips.
Thank you, and may it please the court. I'm Andrew Phillips, here today representing Alan Montonen in this case, and seated at council table with me is Evan Claditas of our office. I would also like to take the opportunity to welcome Mr. Montanon and his California counsel, Robert Jones, in from San Francisco to visit our beautiful state capitol. Today, the court is faced with an issue of extreme importance in today's society. The court has an opportunity to make a pronouncement on public policy and state to potential litigants around Wisconsin that we are going to hold sacred the concept of pre-suit settlement discussions. And to further that policy, we are not going to throw roadblocks in the way of encouraging the settlement of these disputes before we get to the courthouse doors and before they overburden our already strained judicial resources. The specific issue facing the court today is whether an individual traveling to Wisconsin for the express and sole purpose of engaging in settlement discussions is immune from service of process immediately before, during, and for a reasonable time following the end of the settlement discussions. Now, in briefing this issue, Manitowoc Western has spent a great deal of time concentrating upon the Supreme Court's opinion in Burnham versus Superior Court of California. In that case, the United States Supreme Court upheld the law of transient jurisdiction and stated that it comported with traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice. According to the transient rule of jurisdiction, an individual voluntarily present within a jurisdiction when served is amenable to service of process within that jurisdiction. I can't be more clear when I state that Mr. Montanon is not asking this court to depart in any way, shape, or form from the Supreme Court's holding in Burnham. Rather, what Mr. Montanon is asking this court to do is recognize what several other courts across the country have done, and that is the evolution of a well-known and well-accepted exception to the transient rule of jurisdiction, that being the fraudulent enticement doctrine. The last time this court addressed the fraudulent enticement doctrine was nearly 100 years ago in the 1904 case of Saveland versus Connors. In Saveland, this court explained the well-accepted rule of fraudulent enticement as being that an individual who is tricked or lured into a jurisdiction for the purposes of being served with process and is tricked or lured through false pretenses, that service will be quashed and jurisdiction will not attach. I don't believe that this court owes any deference to the trial court's conclusions because the trial court's conclusions were a question of law. Whether an agreed set of facts met a legal standard is a question of law to which this court owes no deference. Moreover, this is a matter of jurisdiction. And when this court looks at a matter of jurisdiction, it can weigh the affidavits and weigh the evidence of record and sits in the same position as a trial court did in making that jurisdictional determination. And that was established most recently by this court in the Kopke case that was here last summer. In Kopke, you had a situation where the court recognized that it has the ability to make independent findings as to whether the given set of facts meets the required criterion of law, that being whether there is personal jurisdiction over Mr. Montman. So in answer to your question, I don't believe this court owes any deference to the trial court's conclusions.
I was just going to say, what about his conclusion that there wasn't any fraud involved here? And what about his conclusion that it was basically at your client's suggestion that this settlement meeting was held? Do we pay any attention to those findings, or do we look at this totally de novo?
I think you look at it totally de novo, Your Honor, and the reason that you look at it de novo is if you look at the specific finding that Mr. Montnam was not lured or tricked into the jurisdiction, the trial court was basing its decision upon the law established in Savlin versus Connors. And that's why we're here today, is to ask for the court to recognize what every other court around the country to address this issue has recognized, that when you're talking about settlement discussions, there's an expansion of the fraudulent enticement doctrine. There's never been a case in Wisconsin where we're talking about the fraudulent enticement doctrine in the context of settlement discussions, and quite frankly, it is impossible for Mr. Montnam to prove actual fraudulent enticement under the Saveland analysis, and the reason is the settlement discussion took place. There is no way for Mr. Montnam to crawl into the mind of Manitowoc Western's representatives and determine fraud without an actual admission from Manitowoc Western.
Well, when did they file the papers in this case?
They filed it on
Circuit Court.
Excuse me. They filed it on April 30, 1996, the morning of the settlement meeting, which was to occur that afternoon.
So you've got the evidence that there was a filing. They knew they were going to go ahead, or at least suppose that they might very well go ahead.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It's all right. You've got that evidence. You've got a whole series of evidence from which an inference of intent can be drawn.
That's correct. And if you look at the two options that the precedent from other courts around the country have adopted in this circumstance, you have two basic rules. The first rule is the bright line rule. The bright line rule has been enunciated in several courts, including Florida, Michigan, Illinois. According to the bright line rule, as the court in the Northern District of Illinois in TMF Tool Company versus Mueller explained, you need to satisfy three elements in order to qualify for the bright line rule. First, that the parties agreed to meet and discuss settlement. Second, that the defendant traveled to the plaintiff's jurisdiction for purposes of engaging in that settlement discussion. And third, that the plaintiff did not warn the defendant or otherwise give the defendant an opportunity to leave the jurisdiction following the meeting.
Counsel, I want to stop you at the threshold again, as I think Justice Crooks began to do, and focus on what the trial court found with regard to its conclusion that the defendant was not tricked or induced by fraud or deceit to come into Wisconsin jurisdiction. In response to Justice Crook's inquiry, you said no deference need be given because the Court of Appeals based its conclusion that there was no deceit on the law of Savlin versus Connors. And as I listen to that, I say, okay, it's a legal conclusion. But the wording of the trial court's opinion is based on these series of facts. And prior to that conclusion, it recounts that there are a series of events that are comprised of both letters and phone calls and what was said. And then the trial court says, based on this series of facts, it is clear that the defendant was not tricked or induced by fraud into deceit to come into Wisconsin's jurisdiction. And I know you were referring to the Court of Appeals. You talking about the Saveland versus Connor case, but don't we have any duty? We can look at those letters, I suppose, as well as the trial court can, but what about the phone calls?
Well, I think that my answer to that question is twofold. The first is a legal analysis, and the second is a factual analysis. With respect to the legal analysis, what I'm saying is that under the Saveland v. Connors precedent and the rigid interpretation of the fraudulent enticement doctrine, Mr. Mottman can't prove fraud. That's the legal analysis. And what I'm asking this court to do is to extend the law, so to speak, and recognize that there are certain circumstances where this court can recognize an evidentiary presumption in favor of finding fraud without an actual factual finding of fraud, but given the totality of the circumstances, it can find fraud in circumstances such as the lawsuit was filed prior to the settlement meeting. The defendant is not given an opportunity to leave the jurisdiction following the settlement meeting. The parties agreed to meet and discuss settlement. The defendant was not warned. That's the legal analysis, and that's what I'm asking this court to recognize, is that there has been an evolution in the law of fraudulent enticement since 1904. With respect to the specific factual inquiry, I think in our reply brief we mentioned to the court that it is the invitation rule, not the initiation rule. That when you look at all of the applicable precedent, it matters not what party first broached the topic of settlement discussions. What matters most is what party said, hey, come to this jurisdiction and let's talk settlement. And I think that if you look at the letter from Attorney Ninneman, Manitowoc Western's counsel, to Mr. Mottman's counsel in April of 1996, you see very clearly that Mr. Ninneman stated, if we are to have a meeting, that meeting is going to be held in Wisconsin. And that, I submit to you, amounts to an invitation to enter into Wisconsin, that if a meeting is to occur, we're going to have this meeting in Wisconsin. Now, following that letter, they did agree to meet. Mr. Mottman agreed to undertake great expense in flying both himself and his counsel to Manitowoc for what he thought were going to be settlement discussions. It would have been very simple for Manitowoc Western to express its true intent and say, we don't want to settle this matter, don't come to Wisconsin. And then if Mr. Mottman would have showed at the doorstep, they would have had an opportunity to serve him. He would have been voluntarily present in the state under no false pretenses. There could be no question about that.
Counsel, I just want to go back a little ways where you were talking about the Bright Line Rule. The Bright Line Rule, as I understand, is a position and there'd be a significant minority. So this is really, it's Bright Line Rule, the majority rule, or is it a minority rule?
Well, I don't know that there is a majority or a minority rule because...
You're asking for us to adopt a rule that once settlement negotiations are going on and that there is a quasi or a actual invitation to come into this state that may then the fraudulent enticement doctrine can be applied. Is that?
I think that the rule that this court must adopt is a totality of circumstances approach, and that's even what the Bright Line Rule courts did.
How does that, you know, I'm looking at the 2002, we have a great deal of technological advances in communications with faxes, teleconferencing, video, whatever. If we have this so-called Bright Line Rule, what would that affect, or should it affect, we're not just talking about this case, other cases which involve where there has been settlement negotiations going on, and then a person comes to California or to the state of Wisconsin, that you're saying there is a prohibition on any type of service at that time. Is that what you're asking for?
Well, I think as long as the parties have a meeting of the minds, in other words, there is an expressed intent on the part of both parties that they're going to meet and discuss resolution of their dispute, that if there is that meeting of the minds, that and then one party relying upon that meeting of the minds travels to the other party's jurisdiction for purposes of engaging in those settlement discussions.
And that would be a bright line rule. Once
Correct.
You have traveled. I mean, you can negotiate and talk about this through the internet or whatever, but as long as there isn't travel, the trigger is that there has been travel and some type of an inducement.
That's correct, because we're talking about an exception to the transient rule of personal jurisdiction. Now, if you look at Section 801.05 of the statutes, which is the long-arm statute in Wisconsin, there are several instances where people are amenable to service of process and subject to the jurisdiction of our Wisconsin courts for acts undertaken or things that they have done both inside and outside the state of Wisconsin. We're not asking for a modification of that rule whatsoever. What we're talking about is specifically the transient rule of personal jurisdiction, where an individual is not otherwise subject to the jurisdiction of our Wisconsin courts, but nonetheless is in Wisconsin, traveling here for the purpose of engaging in settlement discussions. If there is that meeting of the minds, if the parties have agreed to meet and talk settlements, then one party should not be allowed to take advantage of that other party's presence in this state under the transient rule of personal jurisdiction.
Can I back up one step to the fraudulent enticement doctrine as it currently exists? Are you conceding that the facts in this case are insufficient to establish fraudulent enticement to pierce the transient jurisdiction in this case?
Without the
extension of the law that you're asking for.
I would make the concession that under the fraudulent enticement doctrine as set forth in Savelin v. Connors does not satisfy, or Mr. Montanon cannot satisfy his burden under the law of that case. But you must remember that when we're talking about the fraudulent enticement doctrine and the so-called extension that I'm asking for here today, the courts in all other jurisdictions have still used the term fraudulent enticement doctrine. This isn't an exception, so to speak. All it is recognizing an evidentiary presumption that where certain circumstances are present, we are going to presume fraud sufficient to meet the burden established under the fraudulent enticement doctrine.
What's the burden?
The burden under the fraudulent enticement doctrine is that a defendant must show that the plaintiff lured the defendant into the jurisdiction under false pretenses. That's the burden under the fraudulent enticement doctrine. And under the concept of Savelin v. Connors, we would have to prove actual fraud on the part of Manitowoc Western here, which I mentioned earlier we can't do because a settlement meeting did occur.
Clear and convincing evidence?
Clear and convincing evidence, yes. But if you look at the law from other jurisdictions, I believe it was the TMF Tool Court, or it might have been the EM Lubricants Court, that talked about how inducement can be inferred by silence of a party. And that's exactly the situation we're talking about here, where one party changes his or her mind and decides that they are not going to settle this matter in good faith, but rather we're going to take advantage of the defendant being in the jurisdiction, that we can infer settlements, we can infer fraud in those situations. And it was in the Restatement of Torts, and I forget the exact section, where they talked about a business transaction, where you enter into a contract in a business transaction based upon representations of one party. Later on, that party finds those representations to be untrue. That party has a duty to disclose to the other party the untruth of those representations, or that those representations are untrue, prior to closing the transaction. And that's exactly what we're talking about here. Whether Manitowoc Western formed the intent to serve Mr. Montanon prior to inviting Mr. Montanon under that letter by saying, why don't you come to Wisconsin if we are to have a meeting, or whether they formed that intent following the letter, the facts are clear that they certainly formed that intent prior to the settlement meeting. When they formed that intent, they had a duty to either warn Mr. Montanon that he would be served with process in Wisconsin because they were no longer interested in discussing settlement, or they had to provide Mr. Montanon with an opportunity to leave the state once those settlement discussions had ended.
Let me just double back. On page 5 of your reply brief, I'm sure you have it elsewhere, you have the 3 rules. One is the fraudulent enticement doctrine, and you've conceded that you can't satisfy that under a very strict interpretation of the burden of proof, if I understood you. But that if the court views the burden less strictly and is willing to make inferences from these facts, then you might very well fall within that rule. Is that your position?
That's correct.
Okay. The second position that you state, if I understand it, is that the court should expand the fraudulent enticement doctrine to quash service of process upon a showing
One, plaintiff invited defendant into Wisconsin. Two, for the purposes of settlement talks. And three, failed to clearly and unequivocally inform the defendant of the possibility that service should would be had should the negotiations fail. Okay. That's a middle ground kind of rule. And it's the invitation, right?
That's correct, Justice.
Can you satisfy that?
Yes, we can. And as Justice Wilcox asked earlier, what's the majority or minority view? I think that's what Justice Wilcox was referring to with respect to the difference between the invitation rule and the bright line rule. The invitation rule was under the Coyne and Henkel line of cases. And looking at those cases, the courts were concerned about some sort of representation on the part of the plaintiff that induced the defendant to take action and travel to plaintiff's jurisdiction for purposes of discussing settlement.
And your client here, as I understand the facts, wanted to talk settlement, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So the inducement, so that the invitation here is only and not a question of whether the other side wanted to talk settlement, but where the settlement should be, right? What
the
settlement talk should be, right?
That's correct.
So you wanted to read showing that a plaintiff invited, in the key words, invited into Wisconsin.
That's correct.
Not that they initiated the settlement talks or invited the settlement talks, but that they insisted it be here.
That's correct, Chief Justice. And the distinction, and I think I pointed it out in the reply brief, is that it's the invitation rule, not the initiation rule. It takes two parties to discuss settlement. One party can insist all that he wants, that he wants to talk settlement. If the other party is uninterested, they are under no legal obligation to talk settlement. And that's what I'm talking about with that meeting of the minds. Once the parties agree to discuss settlement under the invitation rule, the important consideration becomes who invited whom to what jurisdiction. And what we have in this case is a letter on April 15 of 1996, prior to this settlement meeting, from Mr. Ninneman, Manitowoc Western's counsel, stating, "It would certainly seem appropriate that the two of you now travel to Manitowoc, because prior to this we traveled to San Francisco to discuss these concepts." That is an invitation. I don't think there is a case that would ever come before a court in this country where you would see a formal invitation along the lines of a wedding invitation extended to another party. We're asking the court to look at the totality of circumstances and apply the rule of reason in this case, look at the letters and phone conversations, and determine whether an invitation in fact occurred.
This isn't a wedding. This is a business negotiation, and you're basically asking us to establish a rule that would create a risk-free environment for parties to a business transaction. Why should we do that?
I don't think it's a business transaction because the concept of the fraudulent enticement doctrine and the in quashing service of process because of settlement discussions does not encompass a business transaction. It encompasses the parties getting ready to litigate a dispute. And before they get to the courthouse steps and expend substantial sums of money and put a strain on our judicial resources, we should encourage pre-suit settlement discussions. Not only on behalf of the court system, but on behalf of the parties involved. If this was a simple business transaction, for example, if Mr. Montanam was looking to enter into a contractual relationship with Manitowoc Western about something completely unrelated to the dispute under the option agreement, the fraudulent enticement doctrine would never apply.
Is there any empirical evidence that the risk of the assertion of transient jurisdiction is somehow discouraging parties from engaging in pre-litigation settlement negotiations?
I do not have empirical evidence, but I submit to you that it would have a chilling effect, and I cannot quantify that chilling effect for you, but it certainly seems to me that if the policy of this court is going to be to encourage pre-suit settlement discussions, that this is the type of rule, precisely the type of rule that this court should adopt.
You finish.
I was going to say that as a member of the bar, I should be able to rely upon the representations of fellow members of the bar that tell me they want to earnestly discuss settlement of disputes. And I should be able to advise my client without worrying about my client being served in a foreign jurisdiction that we are going to honestly try to work this out before we get to the courthouse steps and you start spending some substantial money and resources on this litigation. And the way it stands now, a person can trick another person into Wisconsin under the pretense of settlement discussions, and so long as they meet for 10 minutes and discuss in theory the concept of settlement, they can serve that defendant then with a lawsuit that they had filed prior to the meeting. I submit to you that Manitowoc Western came to that meeting on April 30th with the ace in its back pocket and was ready to play it. And the ace was that lawsuit. And they did not come to the table in good faith. And the way that we know that they did not come to the table in good faith is looking at the totality of circumstances. They filed the suit prior to the settlement meeting. They did nothing to warn Mr. Montanon of the fact that they did not want to talk about settlement. They did not discourage him from coming to Wisconsin.
Let me ask you, you just raised a question that kind of is intriguing, because wouldn't, from a counsel standpoint, wasn't that a possibility then of service? When you come to Wisconsin, there is a possibility of service, and unless you have a particular agreement with, and I'm not going to say in this case, but in any case, you would say, we'll come, but we want to make sure that there'll be any refraining from service before we come into the state. I mean, I'm talking about just a thought process, because if this was an unsettled situation, good lawyering would have talked about, you do have the problem. That's why I brought up that, we have video conferencing, faxes, internet, et cetera, et cetera. Once you come into the state and you've had these negotiations, you're, quote, fair game for service.
With all due respect, Justice Wilcox, I think that when we're talking about an attorney advising his client about this, that we're talking about a matter of comedy between people. And that's what I'm talking about, the policy of encouraging pre-suit settlement discussions in this context. I think if the tables were turned under the Comerica Bank analysis, which is in California where they adopted the Coyne and Henkel line of reasoning, if the tables were turned and Manitowoc Western was not subject to service or amenable to personal jurisdiction in California, and Mr. Montanon had invited Manitowoc Western to California, that the Comerica Court would have quashed the service. So what I'm talking about is for this state to take that same step that states in California, Florida, Oklahoma, and all across the country have taken, and that is recognizing the importance of these pre-suit settlement discussions and saying that you're going to apply a rule of reason here and that we are not going to place a burden upon the party who is about to be tricked, but we're going to place the burden on the party who is holding the cards, who is sitting in their home jurisdiction, who is about to serve an unknowing defendant with a lawsuit that they had filed prior to the settlement meeting. Let's place the burden on that party to act with good faith and comedy toward another potential litigant and toward another, toward adversary counsel. And that's what we're asking for today.
You know, that's...
To me, and I mean, I don't want to bring international shoe into this or anything like that, but it just seems to me when you think about the... We talk about sufficient contacts. We're talking about a subsidiary of a company that exists in the state of Wisconsin, someone that worked for that company. I was just saying that in a normal business practice, it would have been, with this danger lurking out there, one of the things that counsel could do, and I'm not saying should have been done, but was to... they could stipulate, yes, I'll come to Wisconsin, but I don't want to be served if I did come.
That's certainly a consideration, Justice Wilcox, and I was not Mr. Montanon's attorney at the time, and I don't know that I would have thought about that, because Mr. Montanon's attorney was a California attorney, and they recognized this exception under Coyne and Henkel to the fraudulent enticement doctrine. Perhaps, I'm sorry, I'm out of time.
Finish the sentence.
Thank you. Perhaps if I were a California attorney, knowing the law in California, I would have reasonably thought that Wisconsin would have the same type of interpretation of the fraudulent enticement doctrine that would have allowed Mr. Montanon immunity from service of process. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Thank you. Mr. Ninneman, representing Manitowoc Western Company, Inc.
Thank you. represent the respondents. Initially, I had intended to quickly review the law and the evolution of transient jurisdiction, starting with Burnham and going into the fraudulent enticement cases, leading to the bright line cases enunciated in Kmart, the invitation, initiation exceptions, and so forth. But when I'm hearing the language about comedy between lawyers and good faith, I'm shifting my argument because I want to go back and have you look at the facts in this case. And as I recite what happened and what the trial court found, I want you to think in the back of your mind whether or not Mr. Montanon was tricked or enticed into Wisconsin, whether or not Manitowoc Western initiated the idea of meeting in Wisconsin, whether or not Manitowoc Western invited Mr. Montanon to come to Wisconsin, whether or not, in the language of the E.M. Lubricants case, Manitowoc Western encouraged him to come to Wisconsin, or whether, in the language of the Kmart case, the Brightline case, did Manitowoc Western engage in conduct that was unbecoming of a Wisconsin corporation?
Mr. Nineman, as you start to tell us about the facts in this case, let me ask you what I asked opposing counsel. What deference, if any, are we to give to the findings of the trial court? Or are we to look at this de novo and look at what was presented to the trial court de novo?
I suggest, Your Honor, you have to look at it de novo. It was presented to the trial court in the form of affidavits, correspondence that were attached to affidavits, affidavits by parties as to what transpired. There was no oral testimony. There was no evidentiary hearing in that sense of the word. And so I believe that the proper standard of review is de novo.
Thank you.
Because of the documentary evidence.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
Suppose it hadn't been documentary. Would your answer change?
My answer would change, yes. If there had been evidentiary testimony, then it's much different. The facts in this case. Mr. Montanon was an employee of Manitowoc Western. He was the general manager. Mr. Montanon had obtained the signature on a so-called option letter to buy the assets of Manitowoc Western. From the time he got the signature on that particular letter, the relationship between Mr. Montanon and Manitowoc Western started to deteriorate. And if you review the affidavit and the documents in record number 22, you will quickly see how adversarial it became. Mr. Montanon was represented during this period by three different law firms. He starts by exercising the option in March of 1995. His lawyers asked for a definitive purchase agreement, which they say could be finalized reasonably within 30 days. He gets the document, the draft agreement, on June 1 of 95. He's told the purchase price is going to be in excess of $11 million. He's asked for comments on the draft. And now we start to look at the relationship. The response is, these are all in the letters, in the affidavit, record number 22. Instead of comments, we get alternative proposals. He needs 2 years to work it out. We start getting proposals in which we are told that Mr. Montanon is, quote, prepared to litigate. Mr. Montanon, quote, will proceed with such litigation as is necessary. By the end of 1995, I suggest that the relationship with Mr. Montanon had gone far beyond that of an adversary. He now starts to write his Dear Freddie letters to Mr. Butler, who is the president not only of Manitowoc Western, but the president of the Manitowoc Company itself, the parent. He sends him chocolate saying, "Dear Freddie, sorry I missed you at a trade meeting, your friend Al." Look at Appendix 138. He sends him flowers with a card saying, "Dear Freddie, understand you would like to reconcile." And then I think the real topper, take a look at Appendix 142, Christmas time. Mr. Montanon sends Mr. Butler a chia pet with a Christmas card, reading that perhaps this chia pet is, quote, "something you can't," four-letter expletive, "up like you did the company." That's the background now in which we start to move about meeting. Mr. Montanon's attorneys, with all this happening, say they want to meet. Read the letters in the appendix 130 to 158 to get a sense of what is going on. And to say that we are initiating or inviting in any sense of the word is an absolute torture of the written correspondence. I wrote Mr. Montanon's attorney, Appendix 137, and I said, "We understand you want to meet. What do you believe can be accomplished?" Appendix 146, I asked Mr. Montanon's attorneys for a general description of a proposal that they want to make to see if a meeting is justified. Appendix 149, I write later to his attorneys and I say, "They talk about a business plan. Would you please give us the business plan so that we can see if a meeting is justified?" And what kind of a response did I get? Look at the appendix 150 to 151, the letter back from Mr. Payne, one of Mr. Montanon's attorneys. Classic letter. He chastises me. I'm not reading his letters carefully. He says, "Let the clients discuss these things face to face." He even asks me if I have shared his letter with my client, as if I don't know my own obligations. And then he closes, Appendix 151, to read the last sentence. He wants me to set up a meeting without delay. I did what he asked me. I set up the meeting. And how did I set up the meeting? And where was the meeting set up? It was in Manitowoc. Let's trace through why Manitowoc. If you'd look at my affidavit, Appendix 131-132, when they first asked about a meeting, they said they would come to Manitowoc. Then they follow up with the letter of April 12, I believe it is, in which they invite us to come to California. I responded, "I'm on vacation," I said. "I'm dictating this from Southern State, trying to keep up the document. What's going on here? I have a feeling maybe what's coming." And so I respond to that, and I said, "Why have you changed the location? We went up to California last time. Isn't it appropriate you come here?" And now you look at Payne's affidavit, Appendix 127. He simply says, "We were unwilling to come to California." That's certainly true. But in any event, Payne comes back and he says, "Look at Appendix 148. On that particular letter, I think it's item 4 or something, it's on Appendix page 148. Al has agreed to meet Mr. Butler wherever it is most convenient to him. He will meet wherever it's convenient to Mr. Butler. Well, Mr. Butler happens to live and work in Manitowoc. And so if you go back to my affidavit, in response, I said, "Mr. Butler is free on 3 days. April 30, May 20, May 21. And he responds with a letter saying, "We'll be in Manitowoc at Mr. Butler's office on April 30 at 2 p.m. Is that an invitation to come here?
So where did you file the lawsuit when?
That lawsuit, Your Honor, was filed in the morning.
What counted?
Manitowoc. And I'd like to comment on a few words about filing that lawsuit. I traced you through this adversarial, hostile period because I wanted you to get a sense of what had been going on for 9 or 10 months. Mr. Montanon was not responding to the draft purchase agreement. The company was losing money. We're waiting for his response. He won't give it to us. And at the same time, he's telling us he's going to sue us. And so now they want to have a meeting. I was fully aware of the Burnham decision. And am I to be faulted for that? The Burnham decision had come out in 1990 in an incredibly strong, clear language. Our U.S. Supreme Court made some very interesting comments. They talked about the transfer jurisdiction being among the most firmly established principles of jurisdiction, no matter how fleeting one's presence. I like Brennan's current. He said that the fact that American courts have enunciated this rule for perhaps a century provides defendant today with clear notice, his words, clear notice, that when you voluntarily go into someone else's state, you may be subject to the jurisdiction in suit. I knew that rule. This time has passed. They're now insisting on a meeting. I am not encouraging. I am not trying to trick. I am not trying to lure. I'm not trying to, one of the cases, inveigle, I guess is the correct pronunciation. It means hoodwink. And anticipating that that meeting was not going to be productive, I took the step of filing a lawsuit to determine and ask the Manitowoc Circuit Court whether or not that agreement was or was not a binding contract. And was that some kind of sharp practice? I suggest to you absolutely not. What happens if general counsel for the company, if later on and the meeting is unproductive, and then Mr. Montanon finally does what he had threatened to do for 9 or 10 months, and he sues us in California. And now we're out in California defending the action, and the general counsel says, well, Mr. Nenneman, when he was here, why didn't you serve him? What's my response? What's my justification? This court reminds the trial bar of this state that our system of justice is an adversarial system. We have obligations to our clients, particularly pronounced in the default judgment area of your decisions. And if I don't protect the interests of my client and look after its well-being, am I subject to being second-guessed or whatever? It was time to bring it to a resolution. If the meeting was unproductive, to move forward. And since he was here, the place to move forward was in the Wisconsin court.
Did you engage in settlement discussions at the settlement agreement? And is that part of the record? If it's not part of the record, I don't want to hear it.
Excuse me, Chief Justice, I'm having just a little trouble hearing.
That's fine. You're not the only one or first one to have difficulty hearing me. I asked whether there were settlement discussions at the meeting, and if that's part of the record. If the response to my question is not part of the record, please so state.
And it is part of the record, and I'd love to just quickly review that. Were there settlement discussions? Sure. Today, Mr. Montanon's counsel says, with the sole purpose of the meeting was settlement discussions. But what did he say was the purpose of the meeting in 1996? Let me just tell you what they said before the meeting, and then I'll take you to the record as to what occurred at the meeting. Appendix 131, Mr. Pang said they would like to come to, quote, propose a business solution, what he called a win-win. Appendix 147, Mr. Pang says they'd like to come to, quote, discuss a business plan. A complete substitution of the option agreement. In 151, when we keep asking, give us the details. Tell us what it is. What is your plan? What do you want to discuss? What is your proposal? He calls it, in Appendix 151, he says, it's a confidential business plan. Now we come to the meeting. That was the meeting, and take a look at the demands. That appears in Appendix 160, I believe, is the correct citation, Your Honor. Yes. Appendix page 160, take a look at paragraph number 5. I believe this was the affidavit of Mr. Butler. He now tells you what is being discussed at the meeting. It was a series of demands. First of all, Mr. Montanon, instead of having a dealership that's limited to Northern California, wanted an exclusive dealership for all of California. He wanted Manitowoc Western to extend its credit so that he could buy 60 additional boom trucks. To add to this, our credit for him to buy, see these things, if you ought to make a comment or two, these boom trucks are mounted on truck chassis. You get them on either International Harvester, Peter built trucks, and you have these booms that are then mounted and built and can go out and they can lift construction and so forth, buckets, concrete, whatever. I might say they're a little more expensive than your average automobile. So we extend our credit so he can buy 60 of these. They want the permanent right to the trade name Manitowoc Western. He wanted the first refusal, right of first refusal, for any additional openings in adjacent states. I mean, we're sitting there with the man who writes Dear Freddy letters, and this is an absolute debacle. And we told them that had you told us what you were going to propose, we wouldn't even have bothered to meet. But now that they're there, and now that Mr. Butler said these are totally unacceptable, I served them. Make no bones about it. I filed that morning, the morning of the meeting, Justice, because I went to the meeting with wondering whether or not, I had no idea what was going to come. But in the event, as it turned out, that the meeting was totally unproductive, then at that point in time, I wanted to get the litigation going as to whether or not there was or was not a valid contract.
Counsel, you make the argument, and make it well, that, you know, what is a counsel to do? You're representing your client, and if I were in your shoes with your opposition here in the state, I'd put a lawsuit on them. Having to fight this out in California. I mean, that's reasonable. The concern I have, and I need your help in addressing, is as a court, one of the policies is to, arguably, it is good public policy to encourage mediation. Mediation is the issue of moment these days. So what happens when good adversary lawyering conflicts with the policy of encouraging mediation. Why should we take our hats off to you and say, yeah, that's great, that's what you should have done. Who wants to fight this thing in California? Why should we do that rather than say, look, we have a public policy as enunciated, and we can find all the enunciation to encourage it, and that's what we should be doing. Help me with that.
I'd like to come back with about five different responses, and I'll try to remember them all, Justice.
Okay.
One, the concept of the public policy of encouraging settlement, first of all, overemphasizes the value of settlement over jurisdiction, state of people who are present within their state. And if you start to go down that road, and a lot of it is because we want to encourage settlement. It, you know, maybe it's an easier evidentiary type of reaction. We don't have to find out who said what and everything else. I suggest you want to go down that road. What's settlement? Every time people meet, is that a settlement meeting? You meet to discuss business, is that a settlement meeting? Somebody that comes to this state and they want to talk about a business proposition and they get served, what are they going to say? Why, we were here for settlement. And you're going to get all mired down into what is and what is not settlement. What happens if you come and part of it is settlement and part of it is business? So I put that off as one. Secondly, in addition to saying what occurs and all of that type of stuff, if you want to have a policy that simply enunciates something clear and simple, Justice Wilcox raised it a little while ago, and we mentioned it in our brief. Why, if you go to somebody else's jurisdiction, don't you have a rule that simply says, I'm coming, and I want it agreed ahead of time that while I'm there, I won't be served. And if somebody violates that, you got a clear, bright line to say there was fraud. You, at the same time, encourage settlement. And it's something that lawyers today are doing all the time when we meet with adversaries in a lawsuit. We say, let's sit down and meet, and let's agree ahead of time that our discussion is going to be confidential. It's for purposes of settlement, and therefore our discussion is not going to be admissible. I mean, that goes on in this state all the time, and you know what. What's wrong with putting that burden on somebody and have a very clear, distinct line?
So the defendant writes you and says, or calls you, emails you, faxes you, and says, I'm not coming to Wisconsin unless you agree that there will be no service from the time I enter the state until I leave, which will be within 24 hours after our meeting. And you would say, it's a deal, right? And then what happens if you serve him while he's there? If the court should adopt your rule. And I assume that's the rule that's referred to in footnote...
It's referred to in our
11
brief.
On page 5 of the reply brief. Okay.
Right. What happens if I then turn around? Don't you have a nice, clear, bright inducement that was untrue? I said to you, come. I won't serve. You come. I serve. I've broken my word.
So that's the traditional rule.
You're coming right back into the traditional rule, and you're laying out a safe harbor that will accommodate the concerns of Justice Bradley. And it's a very simple thing. As I say, lawyers do this today all the time, and you all know it. The other thing that I would point out, if you are to somehow enunciate some entirely different rule, and I suggest the only way that Mr. Montanon would be successful in this matter is if you go to the so-called bright line Kmart and EM lubricant cases. EM lubricant, I might suggest when you read it, it concludes with a bright line, but when you read it, it's not really a bright line case because Judge Grady, Northern District of Illinois, when you read through it, talks about the fact that although the defendant initiated the meeting, that the plaintiff is encouraging the meeting, that saying the defendant initiated the meeting is telling only half the story. So he's got that fraudulent enticement in there. But the only way that Mr. Montanon could somehow grasp some success in this case is if you go to the Kmart Bright Line, which says, don't look at who initiates. You come out with the flat rule that whenever you are here for settlement, you got this automatic cloak of immunity. That bright line, I would suggest, has been criticized because it not only was her settlement, was the meeting a sham? I mean, that's one of the things they're claiming here. We sat and listened to them. I mean, how long do we have to listen in order to have a bona fide meeting as opposed to a sham meeting? So we turn around and we take this bright line prohibition. And now what are we doing? If you're negotiating and you're a non-resident in this state, I can't serve you. But if you're a resident of this state and you claim you're negotiating with me, is there some kind of immunity from suit under those circumstances? Where do you draw the line?
Well, what difference does it make if you're a resident? What difference does it make if you're a resident and you can serve them anytime, anywhere?
Where do you draw the line in terms of saying that immunity from suit should surround settlement negotiations, period? There might be a timing factor as to whether or not a suit should be commenced sooner rather than later. You claim I'm in negotiating with you, and so, I mean, am I now prohibited from serving you?
Like a statute of limitations issue? Like a statute of limitations issue?
I suppose that could be one. I can think of a number of, but that certainly is one. The other suggestion and point that I want to make for a moment, and that is that if you were to depart in this radical wholesale change, flat prohibition, which isn't, you know, the growing thing in this country. It's a couple of cases, federal cases, back in the 80s. Michigan, Kmart, EM Lubricants, Illinois, predating, incidentally, Burnham, coming at a time when courts were wondering about the viability of transient jurisdiction. This court did it in the Oxman case, wondered about minimum context. So these cases all come down before that. If you were to depart and go that direction, in fairness to attorneys in this state, shouldn't that be prospective? We can only act on what is the law at the time we act. If someone is going to adopt some new rule, shouldn't it apply going forward? Why should it undo what we did 6 years ago? Why should we try now to go back and undo all the litigation all the rulings. It started as a simple case involving whether there was a valid contract, and as you know from reading the pleadings, once we got the ruling that it was not a binding contract, did the litigation ever fly. We got sued in California, it got stayed. We got sued in federal court in California, RICO, it got dismissed. I even had the privilege of your reading being identified as a non-defendant participant in the RICO conspiracy. In any event, then Judge Dietz went through and made all his rulings. And now what are we going to do? Start all over again? That's obviously what Mr. Montanon would like, as he doesn't like the results. Well, as we said in our brief in regard to Kmart, that's, I think, an example of bad facts making bad law. I suggest to you in this case, you've got very good facts to support and uphold the traditional fraudulent enticement doctrine. And let's not turn around and take these good facts and create some more bad law.
Mr. Nuniman, primarily as a matter of curiosity, I think, although it might have something to do with mootness, and it probably shows my ignorance, but why can't Mr. Montanon be served today?
I would love to serve Mr. Montanon today. He sits here in the front row. It's not the first time he's been here in Wisconsin. But unfortunately, there's a body of cases that say when a person comes voluntarily to a jurisdiction to either participate or witness court proceedings in which they may be involved, that because of their presence in the context of those court proceedings, I can't serve them.
You learned something.
Oh, Justice, I could tell you.
Counsel? Oh, there are a lot of... Taking that body of law, what if mediation were in some way under the umbrella of the court here? Court-ordered mediation. Would you be able to serve him if he came to this state to engage in court-ordered settlement negotiations or court-approved settlement negotiations? You know, he probably filed suit in California for some reason. I don't know.
Well, I have difficulty with your question, Justice, in the sense that how would we be able to order somebody to come here to participate in court-ordered mediation if we do not already have jurisdiction over the person.
Suppose he wasn't a defendant, counsel, that he was a witness in the, or needed...
Because I have problems with my hypothetical.
No.
That's the way to deal with it.
But the exception does extend to situations in which a person is a witness, and it extends to a party who is not under subpoena, who comes to watch a proceeding. It extends, obviously, to somebody who, in some manner, is responding to a subpoena that comes for another purpose. But there is a very clear body of law that, with respect to attendance at judicial proceedings, there is an immunity. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be in beautiful chambers in a long time. I would just close by saying please uphold the service and the jurisdiction in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Nuniman. Mr. Phillips, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you. Let me start out by saying that this, what we're asking for in the Bright Line Rule, is not a radical departure. We're not talking about a renegade court in the middle of Wyoming that made some rule that we're asking this court to follow. If you look at the Coyne and Henkel decisions, and by the way, Henkel was decided after Burnham, Henkel adopted the court's reasoning in Kmart Corporation. Coyne adopted the court's reasoning in EM Lubricants. These are not radical changes we're asking for. What we're asking the court to do is recognize an evidentiary presumption that every single court that has ever addressed this issue, and that being the fraudulent enticement doctrine in the context of settlement discussions. Every court that has addressed this issue has said that there needs to be a rule in place. Now, they differ as to the specific contours of that rule, but every court addressing this has said, yes, there needs to be a rule in place. And with respect to the Burnham decision, and with respect to Manitowoc Western's insistence that it was only following the law of the land and following Burnham when it served Mr. Montanon, the court in Stanko versus Lamond in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania addressed that very argument. And the court said that they could not find by what manner of torture counsel got from Burnham that it was okay to bring somebody to Wisconsin to talk settlement and serve them with process. And so that very argument was addressed and rejected by the court in Stanko versus Lamond. Now, Mr. Ninneman asked you, what should he do in that circumstance if his client tells him to serve Mr. Montanon while he's in Wisconsin? My answer to my client is he's not subject to personal jurisdiction. I made a representation that we were going to meet and discuss settlement, and that's what we're going to do. I'm sorry I cannot serve him, and I submit to you that's what Mr. Ninneman should have done in this circumstance. But as I state, I was not there. I do not have the benefit of telling you what was going through my mind on that fateful day going into that meeting because I was not a part of the process at this point in time.
Wouldn't that have been legal malpractice? The law did not require that at the time. That's not the law of the state.
I don't think that would be legal malpractice, Justice. There are plenty of rules of evidence, rules relating to different common law principles that are around the country that are accepted and just have not made it to this court. How is it malpractice if you've got two different states' laws and you're just asking for an interpretation or a harmonization between those two different states? I think that's a matter of interpretation.
But the law of Wisconsin at the time your client was served did not require the Manitowoc Company to refrain from serving your client while he was in this state for purposes of settlement negotiations, nor did it require any of the sort of Miranda warnings that you want us to adopt in this setting for purposes of immunizing people from other states who come to this state to meet with our corporate or individual citizens. That's not the law. So.
No, I agree it's not the law. You asked if it was malpractice, and I don't think it's malpractice, because if you look at the precedent from these other jurisdictions, this was coming down the road. I suggest to you that the reason that it hasn't been to this court before today is that this circumstance doesn't happen very often where people say, yeah, let's meet and discuss settlement, and I'm going to serve you with process. I think that when we talk about initiation, we talk about invitation, we talk about this detailed and tortured factual analysis that Manitowoc Western wants this court to avoid, we're not really talking about a detailed factual analysis. Let's look at initiation. Let's look at invitation. Let's look at the totality of the circumstances. It's very easy to determine whether a meeting is in fact a settlement meeting. I ask you to turn to the appendix and look at Mr. Payne's letter, appendix page 147. In that letter, Mr. Payne talks about a mutual release of claims. If there was no dispute and this was really a business meeting, why are we releasing claims? Look at Mr. Ninneman's affidavit in the appendix. In Mr. Ninneman's affidavit, he indicates that had the meeting proved productive, he never would have served the lawsuit and would have filed a voluntary dismissal. That being the case, how could this not have been a meeting to settle the disputes arising under that option agreement for which Mr. Montanon traveled to Wisconsin? And I submit to you, by having Mr. Montanon and placing the burden on him and his lawyer to ask for immunity from service of process is placing the burden on the wrong party. Just as in the Miranda rights that you referred to, Justice Sykes, we do not place the burden upon a suspected criminal to automatically invoke their Miranda rights. We give them a warning. We're asking for the same type of warning in this context.
We're talking about constitutional rights in the Miranda situation and the court's obligation to protect them. Here, what we've got is the Manitowoc Company, a citizen of Wisconsin, using a perfectly constitutional method of service of process, and you're asking us to craft all kinds of new rules for that. Why should we limit the jurisdictional availability of Wisconsin courts to Wisconsin citizens in favor of immunity from somebody from another state?
May I answer the question?
Yes, sir.
Well, I think the simple answer to that is we are talking about constitutional rights, and that is the due process rights of Mr. Montanon. And if
this
you
is a perfectly due process, perfectly consistent with due process, this method of service, and Burnham has established that. So we're not talking about fundamental fairness or any kind of due process notion of fair play.
Well, I respectfully disagree, Justice, and that's based upon the court's decisions in EM Lubricants, TMF Tools, Stanko versus Lamond. We are talking about due process rights.
So it's your position that those cases stand for the proposition that this form of service, when it occurs in the context of settlement negotiation, is a violation of due process?
No, that's not my position. I'm saying that those rights are implicated through personal jurisdiction. What I'm saying is that it's a matter of convenience for the court, and it's a decision on the part of the court to refuse to exercise jurisdiction in situations such as this where a person is brought to a state under false pretenses. And I submit to you that the false pretenses are when a settlement meeting is established and service of process and filing the suit is established prior to that meeting. And I would only note that in here we're talking about, yes, Manitowoc Western is a Wisconsin citizen being incorporated here, but we're talking about a company doing business in California where its primary place of business is a California resident, an agreement executed in California, dealing with assets located in California. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips.